Welcome to Upthinking Finance, a podcast that offers a unique and discerning view of economics and financial planning. Here is your host, Emerson Fersh.
Welcome back to another edition of Upthinking Finance. I'm Emerson Fersh.
Robert F. Kennedy once said, "Only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly." This episode represents the second anniversary of the Upthinking Finance podcast. First episode aired in April of 2022. My guest at the time was Alex Craner. Last year's anniversary episode, titled One, my guest was Alex Craner. So you know who's going to be our guest today. Alex has actually become a really good friend of mine. We met back actually in April of 2021. And through that relationship, we've not only developed a friendship and a mutual trust and respect, but also along with my partner, Amy Lenoble, we've created two price trend following models that we're the only advisory firm in the United States has available based on the iSystem trend following model that Alex has created through Craner Analytics based in Monaco. So he has a background as a hedge fund manager, a futures trader, and he does a lot of work these days speaking on the ever-changing geopolitical landscape. So my goal today is to cover both those things, spend some time on finance and spend a little bit of time as well on the geopolitical landscape. Pleasure to welcome back my friend and colleague coming to us from the beautiful Principality of Monaco, my friend Alex Craner. Alex, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again, Emerson. Always a pleasure to join you.
No, it's good to see you. So gosh, there's always so much to talk about in the intro, mentioning how you do a lot of work speaking on geopolitical things, and we'll get to that. But I sometimes feel that your finance and economic expertise sometimes takes a back seat. So I thought a good place to start, because this is on my mind as a financial advisor, but if you look at the current economic landscape, there's been a pretty much what I'll call a global melt up in equity values, really going back to the beginning of last year. And in the market has a mind of its own, but when you look at things just from a real world, all-encompassing view, it just doesn't make any sense to me because of there's so many reasons why financial markets shouldn't be going up and there should be more turmoil. So I'd like to start with that. What are your observations?
Well, I've been confused about this for a very long time, because when I started out as an investor, it was mid-1990s, right? And remember, back then we had dot-com boom, right? And at that time, the equity valuations have been so high, so unprecedented, that it was in December of 1996 that Alan Greenspan gave a testimony before Congress, and he was warning the markets about their irrational exuberance. And then over the next 5 years, the Nasdaq more than tripled from that irrational exuberance. And in the last 5 months, it gained 110%, just the last 5 months of the dot-com boom. So I was, from the very early years of my career as an investor, I was very confused about what do these stock valuations mean? Why do stocks go up? What makes them go up? And it took me the best part of my career to work out finally that the only factor that matters is the Fed policy. If the Fed QEs, the stocks go up. If the Fed slows down or tightens, the stocks go down. Now, having said that, it would appear that 2023 has been an anomaly, because apparently we had QT, quantitative tightening, and stocks went up at the same time. So I think that the difference is that this time around, the central banks around the world work in coordination. And certain central banks, like the Swiss central bank and the Japanese central bank, cooperate very tightly with the Fed. We know that the Fed has been giving the Bank of Japan very large swap lines, and that a lot of that money, that the US dollar loans that the Bank of Japan obtained from the Fed, were recycled straight back into the US equity markets. Japan was the largest investor in the US stock market in 2023. So the empirical evidence that Fed action is the single most important factor determining how the stock markets do, the empirical evidence goes back for over a century. And what we're seeing today is, again, more evidence of this. And it's not just the Fed. When you see governments like Venezuela and Zimbabwe and Argentina over the last years, in Venezuela in 2015, 2016, there was Israel in mid-1980s, Japan today, you know, look at where Nasdaq is, the Nikkei is at near all-time historical highs. And it shows you that when the crisis of unpayable debt reaches a certain proportion, you have this debt overhang, central banks basically have no choice but to start flooding liquidity into the system. And it seems that most of that liquidity ends up gravitating towards the equity markets. And so even if the economy is in recession, even if things are not looking great on the street, stock markets go up. And Zimbabwe was the world's best performing stock market in 2009, not because things were going great in Zimbabwe, but because this is what was happening. Their central bank was pumping liquidity into the economy. Same thing with Venezuela in 2015 and 2016. The economy wasn't great, but their stock market went vertical practically. So I think that we are now finally starting to see the same phenomenon play out in the Western economies. The United States is a good example, but I think that the same is going to happen in Europe, in European stock markets. And well, the FTSE in UK has been the laggard, but it's treading the very same trajectory. So I think that ultimately it will join the bandwagon.
So more money, obviously, is inflationary. I mean, that's an acceptable principle. You keep putting money in the system, it's inflationary. So
yes, and it's primarily asset price inflationary. You know, it's not so much consumer price inflationary, but asset price inflationary. And that's by design also, because it allows central banks to keep the credit impulse going in whatever way that suits them, without causing very high rates of inflation in the consumer economy. So it works well until it doesn't. And I think that we're now at the point where it's starting to not work so well.
There's two thoughts here. One is our mutual friend that you introduced me to, Russell Napier over there in Scotland. He actually just put out a newsletter this morning that you had mentioned the last time we spoke that Japan was going to be kind of the first, where they go will sort of lead the way. I've heard that actually from a few different people. It's not mainstream by any stretch, but they announced, I guess, a week or so ago, maybe last week, I guess, 19th, that they were going to start allowing rates to go up. But his argument is really they're still going to control the yield curve. And he's been saying all along that this is speaking to your last point about maybe we finally hit a wall here with this QE stuff globally or the Western part of the economies, because his point was that Japan will eventually, they're going to continue to have to find money to keep the yen low, buy their bonds. It's not like all of a sudden rates are going to go up and that's what's going to happen. And so his argument is, as you said, Japan owns, it's over 70% of their assets are in the U.S. directly or through Cayman Island accounts. But if they start to sell, and not just bonds, but even equities, that's the kind of the side you don't hear a lot about, then that's going to start potentially sort of this. So that's part, comment on that if you can, but maybe the other part is, how does this thing blow up? Because no one seems to really be able to explain what that looks like.
Well, I think that the way it blows up is by consumer price inflation overtaking the asset price inflation, which is what we usually get with these inflationary regimes, like I just mentioned, Israel and Venezuela. And I mean, not Israel now in this current crisis, but in the mid-1980s, in 1986, Zimbabwe in 2009, Argentina in 2012, I think, Venezuela and so forth. Usually what happens along the way is that you also have inflation, commodity price inflation, which ends up overtaking the asset price inflation. So maybe the value of your stock portfolio keeps going up in nominal terms. But 100 years ago, when we had the Weimar Republic hyperinflation, the stock market also went vertical, but people still lost almost everything. It was almost 100% wipeout because the Reichsmark was collapsing faster than the stock markets were going up, which is an extremely interesting phenomenon all in itself, because if you manage to preserve any purchasing power, then the real asset becomes so compellingly cheap that you can buy phenomenal things that are unthinkable now for very little money. But with regards to the Bank of Japan, I think that, yeah, theoretically, they could start selling their U.S. assets, but they're not gonna, because this is a relationship between the sovereign and the vassal. It's not like Bank of Japan one day is going to wake up and say like, hey, it's in our best interest to start selling our U.S. assets and start maybe defending the yen. I don't think that's going to happen, because I don't think that they are independent and sovereign in that respect. The sheriff in town is the Fed, and the Bank of Japan is going to do what the Fed demands it to do. I don't think that the Bank of Japan is going to have any trouble keeping the value of the yen from rising, because it's actually pretty much collapsing as we're speaking.
So on the subject of the other extreme, we see the markets melting up as we're treading water with potential World War III, nuclear holocaust. I mean, is there, if there's a potential geopolitical problem in the world that doesn't seem to be a
good time to invest, right? Good time to be in the
So that's the other side. I mean, you know, who was it? Rand Paul the other day talking about black swan events, in which, and for anybody who doesn't know, black swan events are these just out of nowhere market collapses. Black Monday's one I can remember. That's when I first got into this industry. I mean, I guess I'm trying to think of other stuff, but I mean, the idea is these just extreme market reactions that can happen. I guess the great financial crisis would be one too. You know, these once every 10 years or 100 years or whatever they are. But my thought was always they also kind of come out of left field. And when everybody's kind of looking for it, you sort of wonder, is that really a realistic expectation when everybody's calling for it?
Yes, I don't know. You know, this happened, what was it, in 1987? But ever since then, the Fed has pretty much been an active player in the equities markets. That's when the Greenspan put started. And they pretty much never allowed the market to decline by more than, let's say, 20, 30% since the last financial crisis. So we had a big blowout after the dot-com boom, and we had the big blowout in 2008, 2009. But now I think that the regime has really changed. I think that with COVID pandemic, there's been a banking coup. This isn't something that's advertised or really discussed openly, but we had suddenly such a massive influx of free liquidity into the markets. I think that the Fed now, the asset price inflation is the only game in town. I don't know if they're going to let it go. So is a black swan event going to happen? Of course, that's possible. But I think that it's kind of risky to expect it, to think like, oh, these are such unprecedented highs in asset prices. I'm just going to go short it. I think that could be very, very dangerous, because when markets are trending, they tend to continue trending. And equity markets now are clearly in an uptrend. We've reached new historical highs. This is not a small event. As we've seen with things so many times, like Tesla, Nvidia, Bitcoin, cocoa prices most recently, sometimes these trends really do go vertical and they trigger some kind of a buying panic in the markets where it doesn't even matter, you know, what the valuation is. It's just everybody piles onto the buy side. Everybody buys, buys, buys. And then, as we saw with the dot-com boom, 5 months, 110%. The last 5 months of the dot-com boom, it went up 110%. So where are we now? Predicting the top is never a thankful thing to do. So my approach is always to drive in the slow lane and follow the trends and let the trend unfold until it stops and to the level that it will unfold. And then you're never going to sell at the top, but you're going to get a gradual reversal, because even when the dot-com boom reversed, you had like a double top formation that took about 6 months to be complete. And the same thing happened in 2008. Market didn't just collapse all in one day, but there was like a double top formation. I tend to trust trends more than I trust predictions, because you mentioned Russell Napier, but I also used to read John Hussman, who has been predicting a crash over asset valuations, over stock prices being too high, I think pretty much since 2015. Of course, he's going to be right one day.
At what cost?
Meanwhile, right? You could get killed multiple times by succumbing to panic or temptation. My best advice would be to control risk and to trust the trends more than predictions.
No, and that's good. And yeah, I know the tendency is, if anybody's not careful, you can look at all these things and almost every day wonder, well, how does this affect this? And you're right. I think the thing that I've observed on my side of the desk, so to speak, is an unwillingness for anyone to really allow some of these ideas you're sharing, you know, commodity super cycle, the geopolitical stuff, to really enter the conversation. And there is a bit of an ostrich, you know, head in the sand sort of approach. It's just another part of the business cycle. And so what I've learned through this is, you're right. You can't go to extremes, because as you just said, you know, okay, you park your money and wait for the big crash that doesn't come for 10 years. That's irresponsible. But it's also irresponsible not to embrace new ideas, you know, ways to manage money, new ways, as you said, structural diversification, incorporate new ways to manage the risk. That, to me, I think is the responsible path, which is where trend following comes in and a lot of the other stuff that we've been trying to do. For that very reason.
Yes, absolutely. Because if you don't do that, then you're running in the same herd as everybody else. They run while the running is good, but if they come off a cliff at some point, you're part of that crowd, and then you're not doing yourselves any favor or to your clients. So yeah, it's absolutely essential to think new approaches and to try to diversify risk so that if the herd goes off the cliff, at least part of your risk is somewhere where it's adequately diversified.
So you kind of touched on this, and you maybe already answered it, Alex, but just for clarity, so it's separated from other comments. Where does the Fed eventually lose its power? You know, as you said, keep putting money in the system, continue with the QE stuff, because that's really the only bullet you've got in your gun. Is there a point where it just stops working? And is that what you talked about? I think you alluded to some kind of a crash in the value of the currencies. I mean, is that where it ends?
Yes. I think they lose their power by destroying the currency, just like every other central bank in the history of fiat currency and fractional reserve lending. No currency has lasted for ages under this monetary system. And even reserve currencies, because, you know, when you have the reserve currency, then you have an enormous privilege of getting real stuff from exporting countries of the world in exchange for paper or ledger entries. Well, that too runs out. Old French franc was a reserve currency once upon a time. So was Spanish peseta. And so was the British pound. And they all lasted until they didn't. And the dollar is treading the same trajectory there as well. And we are already coming to the point where not only is the abuse of the currency reached unsustainable levels, meaning conjuring credit out of thin air and creating unpayable debts, but also now there's a polarization in the world where certain global powers are saying, we can't go along with this anymore. This doesn't make any more sense. We want to trade in our own currencies. We don't want to depend on the dollar. And I think that the Biden administration has helped this process along with their nuclear sanctions against Russia, because if they will do this to a nuclear power with 6,000 nuclear warheads, then how secure could other countries feel? So the minute a presidential administration doesn't look like the looks of you, they can say, fine, you know, your money is ours now. Tough shit. Yeah, sorry.
You're good. Okay, so let me ask you this then, because you just kind of jumped into one thing I wanted to bring up. I was at a conference 2 weeks ago in Florida, and it was a work thing, and there were some economists there in one of the breakout sessions, and I brought up BRICS. BRICS is one of those things that gets a little bit of run here and there, but no one really takes seriously. And I asked, and this one person has all the credentials, basically said that it was kind of an alliance of, there's a phrase and I'm not thinking of it, but a bunch of countries that are united under one cause, which is they hate the US / the Western, you know, G7 economies, but it's not a strong enough bond to bring countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia together, something like that. Where my brain was, well, no, it's the exact opposite. The mere fact that these countries that hate each other are united together is the problem. I guess that's a question. I mean, from your perspective, I mean, I know you travel everywhere. I mean, is this a real deal or is it just something that sounds good but really doesn't have any clout?
Oh, no. It's absolutely a real deal. And it's incredibly dangerous to the U.S. dollar hegemony, you know, the prevalence of U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, because a lot of these countries are really, really struggling under the loan terms that they had extended from the IMF, the World Bank, and other financial institutions. They usually end up costing an arm and a leg. I think that Egypt today is spending something like 60% of the state budget to service the interest on their loans to the IMF. And the IMF will absolutely not renegotiate it. It's like, that's what you owe, that's what you pay, and that's that. And so what the BRICS nations are doing now is they are encouraging countries to trade between themselves and to trade in their own currencies. So rather than having to sell your produce and your exports for US dollars, which then sit in an account at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, and then to only be able to use those dollars to import what you need, and then to have to always respect the terms that are set for you by the U.S. administration, the IMF, World Bank, or private institutions also like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and so on, countries can just trade between themselves. It's not the hatred of the United States or G7. It's simply hatred of being oppressed, of getting really, really poor deals that keep these countries impoverished when they're actually extraordinarily wealthy. You know, like Ukraine, for example, between 1991 and 2014, Ukraine has been dead last in the world in terms of GDP growth, in terms of economic performance, even though it's a phenomenally resource-rich nation with all kinds of industries and exit to the Black Sea, the breadbasket of Europe, that country should be extraordinarily wealthy, but somehow they've been impoverished. They became the poorest nation of Europe. And the magic is the IMF terms that they have to live with. And so what the Russian and Chinese diplomats have been doing in cultivating their relationship with the nations of Global South and other BRICS nations is they've been telling them, if you trade with the BRICS group, with us, with other nations of the Global South, you're welcome to join us. And this is important, what I'm going to say now. And if you default on your debt obligations to the Western financial institutions, we will not penalize you for that. And if you choose to renationalize your domestic industries and resources, we will not penalize you for that. You're free. So for a country like Egypt, it's the choice. Do we want to spend 60% of our budget servicing our debt to IMF? Or do we want to just simply default, tell them no mas, and trade with other nations because now we can? Before, it used to be impossible. All the trade finance flowed through New York and London and Switzerland. Today, this is no longer the case. So the countries are becoming a bit more assertive, and we've seen a whole wave of that happening in Western Africa, with one country after another having coups and declaring independence and saying, no, thank you, we're going to work out our own problems, we don't need Western help, and we're no longer selling you our uranium at $2 a kilo when the market price is $100 a kilo. You see, and so this is not a small thing. So I would be very careful about the groupthink that tends to grip many economists, especially the published ones, because if you speak the same language, if you keep to the groupthink, you're good. If you raise too many questions and you raise alarm about things that alarm should be raised about, then you may not no longer be part of the group. Groupthink is good while things are stable and going well. But when they don't, you know, you want to keep your eyes and ears wide open. And these developments that are happening around the world, they have to be acknowledged. They are important. And there's going to be a time when there will be consequences felt in the domestic market in the United States. The US dollar will reflect those changes. The interest rate on United States treasuries are going to reflect it, and the Fed funds rate. And so if that's the point of time when you wake up, then you may be too late.
And I appreciate that, because going back to Russell Napier again, we had an interview with him, I don't know, a few weeks ago about the Library of Mistakes and the Mistake of the Year Awards. It was actually, they're really cool over there. My final comment was, there's one common theme in all this, one thing that matters if you're trying to assess mistakes and the causes. And his comment was, look at incentives. What is the motivating incentive? And you're right, for most people, there's just, you're getting paid to toe the party line. That's it. What is the benefit of sticking your neck out because it's safer to stand to the tent with everybody else? I've never operated that way in my life. I don't like it. It makes me uncomfortable. It's my own thing. But the other thing I was thinking of when you were speaking, because there's an element of almost not taking this seriously in this country. And you had sent me the name of an expat that's over in Russia that publishes YouTube videos. I can't remember his name. I was trying to look it up real quick. That's a younger guy that just kind of posts.
Maybe Tim Kirby?
I think so. And I watched some of those videos, and he's showing some community that's on some like body of water that in Russia that was beautiful. And I started thinking, I mean, this is just like, I feel like ignorant American saying this, but what are my impressions of Russia having never been there myself? Cold, dreary, oppressed, because that's what you see in the movies. And then you start realizing, well, you mentioned Egypt. My first go-to, I mean, I'm being real honest here. It's embarrassing, but it's the truth. It's Egypt. What difference does Egypt make in the world economy? It's this mindset that it's limiting. And so that's the thing that I think it's like, there is a lot of arrogance and just, I guess that's the word for it, that it probably exists even at the higher up echelons where people just look at this stuff and brush it off. And it's like you said, before you know it, it's in your backyard and it's too late because you didn't really acknowledge and adapt to a changing environment. I definitely don't want to be that guy, considering we're responsible for managing people's money.
Yeah, definitely. And every part of the world has its advantages and disadvantages. And Russia, you know, I've been there twice and I spent a good amount of time there. It's just a normal place. Russian people are normal people. Unfortunately, whoever is in charge of our societies is bending over backwards to make sure we don't get that impression. I mean, my 12-year-old son, At one point, we watched movies together at home. After a whole series of these movies, he says like, "Hey, Dad, how come it's always Russians, the bad guys? Practically every movie, the bad guys are Russian." And it doesn't help. But I think that things are going to change. Russia and the United States used to have a very, very close friendship throughout the 19th century and much of the 18th century. They used to be allies. You know, if it wasn't for this, let's call it infiltration of the British Empire into the U.S. Structures of power, Russia and the United States would be the natural allies. And I think that the world would be a better place. And I think that there would be a lot that the Americans could sell to the Russians. And there would be a lot that the Russians could sell to the Americans. So you could have mutually beneficial trade and prosperity without any of this need for war and hostility. But I think that that is inevitably coming, because either we're going to blow ourselves up and vaporize the whole civilization, or we're going to have to find a different way, because we are clearly on a path that is unsustainable.
Well, I hope that those days come soon. I'm optimistic.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm also optimistic, but they can't come soon enough.
No, agreed. And I've shared this with you before, but you've been so instrumental in introducing me to a lot of really interesting people, particularly over in Europe. And John Waters, I mean, I could talk to that guy for hours.
I know. Because he's just was a brilliant interview. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed that.
The guy's just a real deal, and he speaks out, and he's, you know, he loves his country, and he's got this heart of gold, and he feels his pain, and he expresses it. And I was like, my gosh, the way this. And yet, you know, he made a comment that something, you know, evil can't exist. When you get down to the core of it, good versus evil, evil can't exist with the good. And the go-to is there's really just too much good, ultimately. But gosh, yeah, it just seems like it's been dragging. So let me ask you this. This was another thing that came to my mind. Let's just suppose unicorn world for a moment here. If you could trash the whole financial system, and I know that's an extreme, but I hear this from clients, you know, the whole thing has to just literally a complete reset on levels, which is what scares people sometimes, because then they start wondering what to do and where to go. And one thing I've learned, no matter how polarizing and extreme things are, the truth, it does settle in the middle somewhere. You know, you got to be prepared and do your part, as we've talked about. But what does a new financial system look like? If you had to just throw out some, just a couple of pillars of a foundation to it, what's that look like in your mind?
Okay, that's a great question, Emerson. And I'll confess that my ideas are a little bit vague on the margins, but let me give it some concrete contours. Because, okay, so to make money more concrete to myself, I had to kind of picture what's the difference between societies that don't use money and those that do use money. Let's say if you think of a native society or a nomad society, they don't need money. They have their goats and sheep and chickens, and they travel and they hunt and they survive. And most of the community, most of the members of that community contribute. And so at some point, I read that in native societies, it takes something like the labor of 23 individuals to support a community of 21 individuals. So not much surplus there. But now let's say they settle down, they master agriculture, and now they produce a surplus. And so now not everybody has to work. And so now let's say that part of the community can say like, hey, we can build a bridge. We don't all have to work on sustenance. We have surplus labor. We can build a bridge to the next valley, and we can trade with the people in the next valley, or we can plow the fields there. And then we create even more surplus. And now we have even more labor that we could dedicate to other things. We can build a cathedral. We can build pyramids or whatever. So I realized that money should actually be a way, the means of exchange that allocates this surplus of society to uses that improve the quality of life of that society. And then, first of all, obviously, the money has to be based on that surplus. So it doesn't have to be gold or silver, but it does have to reflect the productivity of the group, of that nation or that tribe or whatever it be. Because the money entitles you as, let's say, you decide that now you're going to be a poet. You're not going to plow the fields. You're not going to hunt. You're not going to cook. You're not going to build houses. You're going to be a poet. And everybody says, well, yeah, that's nice. Maybe we can use a talented poet in this group. Well, you're entitled to make a living. You don't have to starve to death. And you're going to get so much per month. And then they give you these tokens with which you go maybe to the village store. And they give you, here's your rice and here's your eggs and here's your meat, right? Go home and write poems. But the rice and the eggs and the meat, it has to be there. Or the productive system that supplies all that has to be there, right? So money has to reflect the surplus, the actual wealth of the society. We have a problem when the banker comes into that equation and says like, hey, I could conjure these tokens out of thin air in whatever quantity I choose, and I can lend them to people, and then they have to pay me back with interest. This is actually where a parasite has attacked a healthy society. And now the society starts to work for him. And then this parasite starts to suck out. It starts to leech the wealth of the society to itself. So the money has to be honest money, and it has to reflect a society's existing wealth or wealth producing capacity. And then the allocation of credit to other uses has to be a democratic process, because we all who live in a certain community have the right to decide whether we prefer that everybody be vaccinated and boosted every 6 months, or whether we prefer to spend that money to build a cathedral or to build new schools and hospitals, or even to give everybody $1,000 a month in spending money. People say like, oh, you're advocating modern monetary theory. It's not that simple. It can be done well. It can be done right. And if you were a businessman in a certain community, wouldn't you like people to have spending money? I mean, they come into your store and they have money to spend, right? And then you might think like, well, you know, they didn't earn it. They're not deserving and whatever. But the idea shouldn't be dismissed out of hand because it does have merit. It shouldn't serve the purposes of, let's say, the Communist International to enslave us all and to use social credit, quote unquote, as a means to get us to comply with whatever they make us comply with, but as means of sharing the wealth and the prosperity and the surplus of the productive society that we all live in. And then, you know, whether you write poems or whether you're a doctor, a nutritionist or car mechanic, you're entitled to live in that society and you don't have to be homeless and poor. Why should you? And so when I say this has to be a democratic process, then obviously there's a role for the state in that. Again, as I mentioned in my newsletter today, when they build the Erie Canal in the United States, the cost of trade between the Great Lakes and the East Coast of the United States collapsed by 90%. So now suddenly by building this piece of infrastructure, you're catalyzing the development of the whole region on both ends of that canal. And so that's of tremendous value. Who manages these kinds of projects? They may not be built by private capital because they're huge. They're enormous. It would take so much capital that maybe only the state can be able to step in and take up these kinds of projects. But if it's done through a legitimate democratic process, and if people decide, yes, we want to build a canal here, yes, it's going to be productive, yes, it's going to help us in so many ways, then the state can say, okay, we're going to manage this project. We're going to fund this project. And when it's funded, since it was paid out of the people's wealth and surplus, it belongs to the people. Nobody needs to charge tolls and nobody needs to make profits off of it. It can just belong to the community, to the nation, or whoever built it. And then another thing that where I think the idea has to be formulated a little bit better is, let's go back to the idea of giving everybody $1,000 a month, because we're so staggeringly productive, which is real, which is true, that what are you going to do? You're going to build pyramids, or you're going to have space programs or things like that? That's possible, but you could also give people $1,000 a month to everybody, let's say. And in that case, because one of the problems that we have is corruption, right? So whoever gets to allocate credit, let's say if I were allocating credit through some state institution or through some banking institution, then there's obviously going to be a lot of people pulling my sleeve and saying like, hey, me, I have this great project. And the friendlier they are with me, the more favors that they grant me, the more likely it is that I will say like, well, okay, you know, Emerson, since you want to vaccinate everybody and when you want to develop these mRNA vaccines and we are friends, I guess I'm going to give you the money for your project. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we leveraged the internet to democratize this process. Because if now everybody had $1,000 a month in their pocket, and then maybe there were these crowdfunding platforms online where you could see who is doing what in your community, and then you decide whom you wish to fund. And then maybe you, if you want to develop mRNA platform and vaccinate everybody and boost them every 6 months, maybe you'd have to pitch that to the whole community and you would get only the money that they decide to give you, right? And so if everybody was really excited about being vaccinated and boosted every 6 months, then maybe you would get a lot of support. But maybe if somebody else said like, look, I wrote this beautiful symphony and I want to play it, but I need an orchestra and instruments and I need $1 million to put that together. And people hear the music and they say like, you know what, we could have this. This is beautiful. We want to fund this. Well, maybe then he would get more money than your worthy cause. But, you know,
worthy cause, yeah.
Yeah, but in any case, you know, I think that with the technology we have today, with the productivity we have today, with the ability to share ideas and knowledge and to go deeper and broader into things, we should be able to put all this together and we should be able to really build a world that would be much, much better than anything we've known up until now through history. Obviously, you know, we have to transcend the state that we're in, where for some reason, we get a lot of war, we get a lot of crime, we got a lot of insecurity and control and oppression and censorship. But I think that these are abominations and that they are, I think that the sun is setting for them. And I think that we can see that from the panic of the ruling establishment, they don't quite know what to do with it. And so I think that all that is going to collapse and implode, but we have to be ready with solutions for the future because otherwise they're going to impose theirs on us. And they're already trying with this CBDCs and things like that.
When you mentioned that the oppressors, the elites, whatever, blue bloods, I don't know, whatever it is, you know, cabal, but anybody looking for evidence that they're clearly scrambling, the fact that ISIS has miraculously reemerged in the news as the perpetrator of the Moscow terror attacks and the U.S. intelligence department, which that's an oxymoron in and of itself, is supporting this. That just, I mean, I saw that, I couldn't stop laughing. I mean, I thought, really? I mean, why not just blame Antifa? And so there's an element of it's ludicrous. And there was a time when I wouldn't have even paid attention to this. But now you can't not look at these things and just realize this just makes no sense. But just one thing, you know, I was listening to what you're talking about, a shift, and there's some things that there shouldn't be anybody on this planet that starves. I was thinking of the parable of the talents. I mean, not to get biblical, but it's an interesting lesson because the one has the five, one has the two, one has the one. And the only one that's, you know, cast out is the one who doesn't do anything with what they have. And I mean, everybody comes here with different abilities. Why isn't the poet or the songwriter or the creative talent able to express themselves? Well, you can't even afford, I mean, rent in like where I used to live in Long Beach area now. I mean, a one bedroom apartment is $3,000. I mean, how do you afford that when you're trying to pursue a creative endeavor in which there's nothing wrong with? If that's your gift in the world to bring, that's the problem is what you're saying is the structure doesn't allow for people to really become genuine or whole. And Charles Hugh Smith, you know, I know we both share alike for him. That's his kind of angle on all this is that social gap where the rich get richer and the poor not only get poor from a monetary standpoint, let's say, but they're poor spiritually because they can't be who they are. And that's the disconnect where this 1% that keeps getting more and more, accumulating more and more in this system separates it. And I think that's a component of all this too, that just why it can't continue. Their souls are dying, I think.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that it doesn't work for anybody really, because suppose you're part of the 0.01% class, the owner class, as they like to say it. You depend on a lot of people, right? You need to hire people. You need help, right? And then, you know, if you go out, you may feel insecure. You may need security. You may have to hire security detail. And still, you know, you have a lot more than they have. And somebody might like what you have. So your security detail, you might come to think of them as a threat, actually. You know, they might kidnap members of your family and then say, that'll be $100 million if you want to see them alive or something like that. And so then what do? You end up living a life of almost permanent fear and anxiety, even though you should be blessed with living the best life that could be lived. And so it doesn't work for anybody. It doesn't work for the poor people, but it also doesn't work for the extremely rich people. And even moderately rich people today, if you walk downtown in any U.S. city today, it's not like you enjoy how beautiful things are and how relaxed you can be there. It's like people doing drugs. There's homeless people everywhere. There's car theft. There's violent crime over purses and wallets for kind of like what I experienced in the third world. I lived in Caracas for a period of time, and you could be killed for a pair of sneakers. And I'm not talking about Chavez's time. I'm talking about pre-Chavez's time, lest people think that it was all milk and honey before Chavez came on the scene. No, it was like that before him as well. That's why he came on the scene. And so the social arrangement just simply doesn't work. It needs to be overhauled. It needs to be thought through again. And groupthink won't do. Groupthink where people tell you like, oh no, everything is fantastic. All of this other stuff doesn't matter. Just buy stocks, pay us our commissions and our fees. Don't worry about anything else because everything's awesome and it's going to last for 10,000 years or 10 million years. It just simply isn't. So we can't afford to be passive and acquiescent as things are imploding because we are responsible for the way we leave the world to the next generation. So we need to stop and think things through and try to figure out ways that we can improve things, or if they can't be improved, then overhaul and start over.
My wife said something this morning. We were out walking our dogs and she said, life isn't meant to be a struggle. Sure, there's, you know, we have challenges and there's all this stuff, but it's not meant to be a struggle. And I was thinking about that and she's actually right. And then of course you described where are the struggles and it's a system that perpetuates struggling no matter where you sit. You're right. You're trying to protect what you have. I mean, there's industries built on all this, right? Insurance. My dad once, I got to share this with you real quick and I'll let you go, but he shared he had an idea once and it was kind of a manuscript or like a, you know, what do you call it when, you know, screenplay called The Cure All. And basically his idea was if every disease was cured, kind of ironic because this is going back to like the mid 80s, what would be the need? And, you know, you start checking off the things that what would be the need for? You certainly wouldn't need insurance. Religion then would become, I mean, all these things, maybe they don't become extinct, but they certainly are significance and role shifts. And it's kind of an interesting idea because it's sort of at root what you're talking about here is the literally this whole, it has to be dug up to where even as people, I like nice things, Alex. I enjoy spending money on nice stuff. Felt responsible in life and, you know, make sure we don't carry debt and all that. But I like nice things, but, and there's nothing wrong with that to a point, but generally there's things somehow seem out of whack sometimes from a balance standpoint. And I think that speaks to, it's not just money. Like, I mean, you expressed it perfectly. There's a greater purpose here, which is allowing people to fulfill who they're meant to be. It's a big, 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 it's not just, you know, I start off with a simple question, you know, how do you overhaul the financial system? But it's got tentacles in everything.
Yes, absolutely. Because this system of the fraudulent monetary system that we have today is poisoning absolutely all relationships in society. And if you fix that, it almost boggles the mind how much better life could be. And so I think we definitely should ponder that because there are ways to fix things.
No, I never know where these conversations are going to go, but I appreciate your time and friendship. I've said it before, but I just feel it's important to express just the mere fact you and I are having these kind of conversations. And it kind of speaks to that bigger world and this using the internet and this ability to connect with people for a real positive. And I think the fact that I know you spend a lot of time talking and sharing your thoughts. To me, you're one of the kind of the pillars of what's going on right now. You and your views and your heart are needed right now in this world. Certainly, you've benefited me personally from a ability to provide clients a solution that nobody else has. And I think that's pretty cool, but it's bigger than that. And I'm just grateful that you continue to put the time into speaking your truth, because I think the more and more people are doing that, they're beginning to see this world is a lot bigger than what we're seeing on TV and reading in the newspaper. It's people, and we're all connected at the end of the day. And I think if we could hang on to that thought, maybe that's a start for moving in a better direction.
Yes, absolutely. Emerson, thank you so much. That's very kind. And the feeling is very much mutual. Thank you for giving me the platform to speak in this way and the open space to vent, to express all these ideas. I think it's a worthy pursuit because ultimately, the quality of thinking determines the quality of solutions we can come up with. And the beautiful thing about the internet and all these technologies we have today now is that we can dare venture, even if we're not certain, even if maybe we might be wrong, because I've seen it happen again and again. You know, you express something, and if you got it wrong, somebody will set you straight. Because there's so many smart people out there. And I think that the process is almost magical. You know, like Isaac Newton used to say, if I could see so far, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants. And I think that today the process has gone kind of organic. It's not that we stand on shoulders of giants. It's like we're climbing on top of one another. It's almost like a vine that's growing bigger and thicker and goes higher. And we can see things and find solutions to problems that maybe were never possible in the past. I think if we take this far enough, we might even figure out how to build pyramids again.
Well, I tell you what, metaphorical or otherwise, I'm inclined to
agree. Yeah, I meant metaphorical. I'm not.
Yeah, no. Well, you never know.
I wouldn't know what to do with a pyramid if I built one.
Yeah, I like to figure out. Yeah, no, that's another topic for the next one. But listen, Alex, thanks for your time. Have a great day. God bless.
Great pleasure, Emerson. Always warm greetings from Monaco to all your viewers and listeners.
Thank you.
Emerson Fersh is a registered representative with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisor services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor and separate entity from Capital Investment Advisors. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. The guest speakers and the companies they represent are not affiliated with or endorsed by LPL Financial or Capital Investment Advisors. Individual tax and legal matters should be discussed with your tax or legal expert. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. There is no assurance that the techniques and strategies discussed are suitable for all investors or will yield positive outcomes. The purchase of certain securities may be required to affect some of the strategies. Investing involves risks, including possible loss of principal.